and gifts that I have for you." He placed the reins in Ralph's hand. "That is one," he said evenly, but the green shadows in his eyes betrayed how dearly that gesture had cost him. "The other is in Tom's saddlebag. It's a book of notes. Read them at your leisure. You may find them of interest, even of value." Still, Ralph could not speak. He held the reins awkwardly and blinked back the stinging under his eyelids. "There is one other small gift, but it has no real value. It is only my blessing."
"That is all that I really wanted," whispered Ralph.
It was 600 miles to the Shashi River, to the border of Matabeleland. Isasi inspanned at dusk each evening, and they trekked through the cool of the night. When the moon went down and it was utterly dark, then Omphan threw the lead rein over Dutchman's head, and the big black ox put his nose down and stayed on the track, like a hunting dog on the spoor, until the first glimmering of dawn signalled the outspan. During a good night's trek they made 15 miles. But when the going was heavy with sand, they might make only 5 miles. During the days, when the cattle grazed or chewed the cud in the shade, Ralph saddled up Tom, and with Butso running beside his stirrup, they hunted. They found herds of buffalo along the banks of the Zuga River, the river on whose banks Ralph's father had been born. Big herds, 200 beasts together. The herd bulls were huge, bovine, and bald with age, their backs crusted with the mud from the wallow, the spread of their armoured heads wider than the stretch of a man's arms, the tips of the polished black horns rising into symmetrical crescents like the points of the sickle moon, while the bosses above their broad foreheads were massively crenellated. They ran them down, and Tom loved those wild flying chases every bit as much as his rider. They chased the ghostly grey Gemsbok over the smoking red dunes, and in the thorn country they hunted the stilt-legged giraffe and sent their grotesque but stately bodies plunging and sliding to earth with the crack of rifle fire, the long, graceful necks twisting in the agony of death like that of a swan. They baited with the carcasses of zebra, and the coppery red Kalahari lions came to the taint of blood, and Tom stood down their charge. Though he trembled and snorted and rolled his eyes at the shockingly offensive cat smell, he stood for the shot which Ralph took from the saddle, aiming between the fierce yellow eyes or into the gape of rose-pink jaws starred with white fangs. Thus, 50 days out from Kimberley, they came at last to the Shashi River, and when they had made the crossing, Butso was on his native soil. He put on his war plumes, and carrying his shield on his shoulder, he walked with a new spring and joy in his stride as he led Ralph to a hilltop from which to survey the way ahead.
"See how the hills shine," Butso whispered, with an almost religious fervour.
And it was true. In the early sunlight, the granite tops gleamed like precious jewels, soft, dreaming ruby, delicate sapphires, and glossy pearl shaded like a peacock tail into a fanfare of colour. The hills rolled away, rising gradually towards the high central plateau ahead of them, and the valleys were clad with virgin forest.
"You never saw such trees on the plains around Kimberley,"
Butso challenged him, and Ralph nodded. They stood on soaring trunks, some scaled like the crocodile, others white and smooth, as though moulded from potter's clay, their tops sailing into traceries of green high above the open glades of yellow grass.
"See the buffalo herds, thick as cattle."
There was other game. There were small family groups of grey kudu, pale as ghosts, trumpet-eared, the bulls carrying the burden of their long black corkscrew horns with studied grace. There were clouds of red impala antelope upon the woven silk carpet of golden grasses. There were the darkly massive statues of the rhinoceros, seemingly graven from the solid granite of the hills, and they were the noblest antelope of all, the sable antelope, black and imperial, as the name implied, the long horns curved and cruel as Saladin's scimitar, the belly blazing white, the neck of the herd bull arched haughtily as he led his lighter-coloured females out of the open glade into the cool green sanctuary of the forest.
"Is it not beautiful, Henshaw?"
Butso asked.
"It is beautiful."
There was the same awe in Ralph's voice, and a strange, unformed longing in his throat, a wanting that he knew could never be satisfied, and suddenly he understood his own father's obsession with this fair land.
"My north," as Zuga called it.
"My north," Ralph whispered. And then, thinking of his father, the next question came immediately to mind.
"Elephant? In Clovo?"
"There are no elephant, Butso. Where are the herds?"
"Ask Bakela, your own father," Butso grunted. "He was the first to come for them with the gun, but others followed him. Many others, when Gundang, my father, son of Mzilikatsi the destroyer, half-brother of the great black bull Lobengula, when he crossed the Shashi as a child on his mother's hip, the elephant herds were black as midnight upon the land, and their teeth shone like the stars. Now we will find their bones growing like white lilies in the forest."
In the last hours of daylight, when Butso and Isasi and Omphan still slept to fortify themselves for the long night's trek, Ralph took the leather-bound notebook out of Tom's saddlebag. By now the pages were dog-eared and grubby from the constant perusal to which Ralph had subjected it. It was the gift that Zuga Ballantyne had given him on the bank of the Farl River, and the inside cover was inscribed, "To my son Ralph, may these few notes guide your feet northwards, and may they inspire you to dare what I have not dared. Zuga Ballantyne." The first 25 pages were filled with hand-drawn sketch maps of those areas of the land between the Zambezi and the Limpopo and the Shashi rivers over which Zuga, and before him the old hunter Tom Harkness, had travelled. Often the map was headed by the notation, "Copied from the original map drawn by Tom Harkness in 1851. Ralph recognised the unique value of this information. But there was more. Page 21 of the notebook bore a terse explanation in Zuga's precise, spiky hand. "In the winter of 1860, while on trek from Tet on the Zambezi River to King Mzilikatsi's town at Tabasindunas, I slew 216 elephant. Lacking porters or wagons, I had perforce to cache the ivory along my route. During my later expeditions to Zambezia, I was able to recover the bulk of this treasure. There remain 15 separate caches, containing 84 good tusks, which I was for various reasons unable to reach. Here follows a list of these caches, with directions and navigational notes to reach them." And on page 22, the list began. "Cache made, 16th of September, 1860. Position by sunsight and dead reckoning, 30 degrees 55 minutes east, 17 degrees 45 minutes south. A granite copy which I named Mount Hamden, the largest for many miles in any direction, distinct peak with three turrets. On the northern face between two large Ficus natalensis trees, there is a rock fissure, 18 large tusks, total weight 426 pounds, placed in fissure and covered with small boulders." The current price of ivory was 22 shillings and sixpence the pound, and Ralph had added the total weights of the ivory still lying out in the felt. It exceeded 3,000 pounds, a great fortune waiting merely to be picked up and loaded on his wagon. Still, that was not all. The final entry in the notebook read, "In my book, A Hunter's Odyssey, I describe my discovery of the deserted city, which the tribes call Zimbabwe, a name which can be translated as the Graveyard of the Kings. I described how I was able to glean fragments of gold from the inner courtyards of the walled ruins, a little over 50 pounds weight of the metal in all. I also carried away with me one of the ancient bird-like statues, a souvenir which has been with me from that time until very recently. It is possible that there is precious metal which I overlooked, and certainly there remain within the walled enclosures six more bird carvings which I was unable to bring away. In Hunter's Odyssey I deliberately refrain from giving the location of the ancient ruin. As far as I know, it has not been rediscovered by any other white man, while a superstitious taboo forbids any African to venture into the area. Thus, there is every reason to believe the statues lie where last I laid eyes upon them. Bearing in mind that my chronometer had not been checked for many months when these observations were made, I now give you the position of the city as calculated by myself at that time. The ruins lie on the same longitude as the copy which I named Mount Hamden, on 30 degrees 55 minutes east, but 175 miles further south at 20 degrees 0 minutes south. There followed a detailed description of the route that Zuger had taken to reach Zimbabwe, and then the notes ended with this statement. Mr. Rhodes offered the sum of £1,000 for the statue which I rescued. The following noon, Ralph took the brass sextant from its travelling battered wooden case. He had bid 10 shillings for it at one of the Saturday auctions in the market square of Kimberley, and Zuger had checked its accuracy against his own instrument and showed Ralph how to shoot an apparent local noon to establish his latitude. Ralph had no chronometer to fix a longitude, but he could guess at it from his proximity to the confluence of the Shashi and Maklutsi rivers. Half an hour's work with Brown's nautical almanac gave him an approximate position to compare with the one that his father had given in the notes for Zimbabwe. Less than 150 miles, he muttered to himself, still squatting over his father's map, but staring eastwards. £6,000 just lying there, Ralph said quietly, and shook his head in wonder. It was a sum difficult to imagine. He packed away the sextant, rolled the map, and went to join the slumbering trio beneath the wagon for what remained of the drowsy afternoon. Ralph woke to a stentorian challenge that seemed to echo off the granite cliffs above the camp. Who dares take the King's Road? Who chances the wrath of Lobengula? Ralph scrambled out from under the wagon. The day was almost gone. The sun flamed in the top branches of the forest, and the chill of evening prickled his bare chest. He stared about him wildly, but some instinct warned him not to reach for the loaded rifle propped against the rear wheel of the wagon. Below the trees the shadows were alive. Blackness moved on blackness, dusky rank on rank. "Stand forth, white man," the voice commanded. "Speak your business. Let the white spears of Lobengula turn to red." The speaker stepped forward, out of the forest to the edge of the camp. Behind him the ring of dappled black and white war shields overlapped, edge to edge in an unbroken circle surrounding the entire outspan. The bull's horns of the Matabele fighting formations. There were many hundreds of warriors in that deadly circle, and the broad stabbing spears were held in an underhand grip so that the silver blades pointed forward at belly height between the shields. Above each shield, the frothy white ostrich feather headdress trembled and swayed in the small evening breeze, the only movement in that silent multitude. The man who had broken the ranks was one of the most impressive figures that Ralph had ever seen. The high crown of ostrich feathers turned him into a towering giant. The breadth of his chest was enhanced by the flowering bunches of white cartels that he wore on his upper arms. Each separate tail had been awarded him by his king for an act of valour, and he wore them not only on his arms, but around his knees also. His broad, intelligent face was lightly seamed by the passage of the years, as though by the chisel of a skilled carpenter, forming a frame for the dark, penetrating sparkle of his eyes. Yet his chest was covered with the elastic muscle of a man only just reaching his prime, and his lean belly rippled with the same muscle as he moved forward. His legs were long and straight under the kilt of black spotted civet tails, and the war rattles around his ankles rustled softly at each pace. "I come in peace," Ralph called, hearing the catch in his own voice. "Peace is a word that sits as lightly on the tongue as the sunbird sits upon the open flower, and as lightly does it fly." There was movement beside Ralph, and Butso came from his bed under the wagon. "Baba," Butso said reverently, and clapped his hand softly at the level of his face. "I see you, Baba."
The sun has been dark all these years, but now it shines again. My father!
The tall warrior started, took a swift pace forward, and for an instant a wonderful smile bloomed upon the sculptured ebony of his face. Then he checked himself, and drew himself up to his full height again, his expression grave. But the feathers of his headdress trembled, and there was a light in his tar-bright eyes that he could not extinguish. Still clapping his hands, stooping with respect, Batso went forward and knelt on one knee.
Igandang, son of Mzilikazi, your eldest son, Batso the Axe, brings you the greetings and the duty of his heart.
Gandang looked down at his son, and at that moment nothing else existed for him in all the world.
Baba, I ask your blessing.
Gandang placed his open hand on the short, cropped, fleecy cap of the young man's head.
You have my blessing, he said quietly.
But the hand lingered. The gesture of blessing became a caress. And then slowly and reluctantly, Gandang withdrew the hand.
Rise up, my son!
Batso was as tall as his father, and for a quiet moment they looked steadily into each other's eyes. Then Gandang turned and flirted his war shield, a gesture of dismissal, and instantly the still and silent ring of warriors turned their own shields edge on, so that they seemed to fold like a woman's fan, and with miraculous swiftness they split into small platoons and disappeared into the forest. Within seconds it seemed as though they had never been. Only Gandang and his son still remained at the edge of the camp. And then they, too, turned and slipped away like two shadows thrown by the moving branches of the mupani trees.
Itsasi came out from under the wagon, naked except for the sheath of hollowed gourd covering the head of his penis, and he spat in the fire with a thoughtful and philosophical air. Shaka was too soft, he said. He should have followed the traitor Mzilikazi and taught him good manners. The Matabili are upstart bastards with no breeding and less respect.
Would a Zulu Induna have acted that way? Ralph asked him, as he reached for his shirt.
No, Itsasi admitted. He would certainly have stabbed us all to death. But he would have done so with greater respect and better manners.
What do we do now? Ralph asked.
We wait, said Itsasi, while that vaunting dandy, who should wear the Induna headring not on his forehead, but around his neck like the collar of a dog, decides what should become of us.
Itsasi spat in the fire again, this time with contempt.
We may have long to wait. A Matabili thinks at the same speed as a chameleon runs.
And he crawled back under the wagon and pulled the karos over his head. In the night, the cooking fires from the camp of the Matabili Impi down the valley glowed amber and russet on the tops of the mupani, and every time the fickle night wind shifted, the deep melodious sound of their singing carried down to Ralph's outspan. In the grey dawn, Batso appeared again, as silently as he had disappeared.
My father, Gandang, Induna of the Inyati Regiment, summons you to Indaba, Henshaw.
Ralph bridled immediately. He could almost hear his father's voice. Remember always that you are an Englishman, my boy, and as such you are a direct representative of your queen in this land. The reply rose swiftly to Ralph's lips. If he wants to see me, tell him to come to me. But he held the words back. Gandang was an Induna of 2,000, the equivalent of a general. He was a son of an emperor and half-brother of a king, the equivalent of an English duke, and this was the soil of Matabili land on which Ralph was an intruder.
Tell your father I will come directly. And he went to fetch a fresh shirt and the spare pair of boots which he had taught Amfan to polish.
You are Henshaw, the son of Bakela.
Gandang sat on a low stool, intricately carved from a single piece of ebony.